Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Now, the United States' assessment of the Islamic Republic of Iran has been problematic since the victory of Iran's revolution in 1979. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has reiterated the U.S.'s miscalculations regarding Iran. He said Washington thought with its terror assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani that all of his efforts would have been in vain. But the reality, he says, is that the opposite is true. The committed people of Iran are following and continuing his way more now than ever before. So at the end of the day, what does it all mean? Stay with us as we take a look at this on the Spotlight.
Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has delivered a speech on the anniversary of an uprising in the Iranian city of Qom on January 9, 1978, against the toppled U.S.-backed Pahlavi regime. The leader reminded the United States of its miscalculations and wrong policies toward the Iranian nation. He pointed to the visit of then-U.S. President Jimmy Carter to Iran several days before the Qom uprising. In that visit, Carter had described the circumstances of Iran under the Pahlavi regime as an island of stability. But later, Ayatollah Khamenei said Carter had to try to quell more uprisings across Iran to prevent the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution, a goal he failed to achieve. The leader said the U.S. has made more miscalculations regarding Iran. He added an outstanding example is the 2020 assassination of anti-terror icon Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Since the Islamic Revolution, successive U.S. presidents have left no stone unturned to achieve their anti-Iran ambitions through different means, including military threats and imposition of sanctions. In line with that policy, former U.S. President Donald Trump in 2018 withdrew his country from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, known as the JCPOA. That's a deal Iran clinched in 2015. Trump imposed tough sanctions on Iran as part of his so-called maximum pressure campaign, a policy incumbent American officials, including Secretary of State Antony Blinken, have explicitly admitted that has failed. Nonetheless, the current U.S. administration seems to be pursuing the wrong policies of its predecessors toward Iran. One example proving that is the U.S. refusal to remove the anti-Iran sanctions in order to pave the way for reviving the JCPOA that got into trouble because of Washington's withdrawal. Now, it's up to the White House to decide to take a lesson from those wrong policies and reverse course, or continue the same anti-Iran agenda.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the Spotlight. Out of Berkeley, Paul LaRudy, activist and political commentator. And Elijah McNair, veteran journalist and political analyst out of Brussels.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome you both to the program. Well, let's start this off in Berkeley. And Paul, your overall assessment, what is it all about, Paul? There's so much animosity that comes from Washington towards Tehran that even started, even leading up to the revolution, even before the revolution miscalculation. What is it all about in your perspective?
Marzia, I think there is what you can call a more global view and also a very short-term view. The situation actually at the time of General Soleimani's assassination was that, let's say, there was an opportunity that was spotted by the military, saying an opportunity for assassination, that is. And it means that they were, of course, watching his movements and preparing for the possibility of assassination. And the short-term view is that they presented that to Trump and to President Trump, and President Trump saw it as an opportunity for him. That is to say, he was not being presented very well in the press, and he decided that an assassination like this, regardless of its actual strategic value, would boost him in the polls and make him appear to be a hero, or at least become a hero in the press, if you will, on a very short-term basis. And he took it. He wanted the glory, if you will, as the United States would see it. But there is another.
Hey, Paul, what exactly does that mean? I mean, you say that basically he took the bait. He decided that's what he wanted. He wanted the glory. But the system in the U.S. is not really individual-based as such. Wouldn't you say, I mean, there's something extremely problematic, to say the least, about an entity that sits down and thinks that, oh, okay, so assassinating this general representing another country on a diplomatic mission is actually an opportunity. I mean, let's look at that side of things and what we're saying about that entity.
Well, that's the other side of what I was going to mention. That is to say that there's a larger picture, but on balance, it's very possible that, you know, there were equal sides on the issue within Washington's and the Pentagon's calculating as to whether they should do it or not. But the side that had a, let's say, a more calculating and long-term view realized that General Soleimani was a problem for the United States because he was eliminating the terror threat in the Middle East, and because he had negotiated with Putin and was important in persuading Putin to join the fight in Syria in a limited way at that time, and because he unified forces in the region and the views, and because he had the respect of all of that, and so in that sense, they wanted him out of the way for these reasons.
Okay. Stay with me, Paul. Yeah. Let me get Elijah in on this conversation. Elijah, in the early days of Iran's revolution, Washington continued to say that Imam Khomeini was going to die any day, and after he would die, then the revolution basically would be over. And we've seen so many different types of miscalculations along the way. And, of course, with the assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, I want to talk about that aspect, that it really expected the resistance in the region to be stunted now, to basically to be impeded or to go in another direction by assassinating him. Of course, he was a very, very important figure. But as the leader of the revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, said today, with his assassination or his martyrdom, actually, support for the resistance has grown.
Thank you for having me. I think what really happened is we can't exclude the ignorance of President Trump and the team he had around him to inform him that removing or assassinating General Qasem Soleimani would deter the access of the resistance, would weaken Iran, because everything is related to one man and one man only. And that's pure ignorance, really, because the axis of the resistance is made of several population who have decided to fight against the U.S. hegemony and dominance, and they want the U.S. forces outside of their country. Now, that is not depending on one man. It is the ideology, it is the country, it is the principle, and it is the fight behind the cause and not behind one single man. And when President Donald Trump assassinated Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the Daesh emir, he thought that Qasem Soleimani could be more or less the same thing at the same level, and he can get rid of him like he did with Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi without soliciting any reaction. And what he did in a moment when the color revolution was starting to pick up a little bit in Iran, where people in the street were destroying banks and official institutions, creating havoc in the country, burning gasoline station, etc. And the Americans, with their limited thinking, they thought we can create more, we can give more boost to this movement of the population that the Americans are behind, and we can cripple more Iran and submit it so it accepts the U.S. dominance, and it, at the end of the day, it aligns itself for what we want. This is why Donald Trump imposed maximum pressure on Iran to cripple the population and submit Iran. So by assassinating unlawfully an envoy of Iran and an advisor to the Iraqi government in Iraq, in Baghdad, he thought that he can get away with it and it would be a simple act. He didn't realize that Qasem Soleimani boosted a new blood in the revolution in Iran, because we saw millions of people in Iran, but also we saw millions of people in Iraq. And that also helped the axis of the resistance to remember who is the enemy, and that the U.S. should be removed from the area, because the only thing it is doing is just killing, particularly a general who was the main force behind defeating ISIS in the Middle East.
What about that, Paul? I mean, Elijah said that there's ignorance there, especially dealing with Trump and those around him. But we're not just talking about the 4 years that Trump was president. We're talking about more than four decades of miscalculation in dealing with the Islamic Republic of Iran. What is that about? I mean, what exactly does that mean? We have many strategists, all kinds of think tanks in Washington and beyond. So, your assessment of it.
Thank you. That's right on point, Marzia. And Elijah is absolutely right. There's one side of it that's based on ignorance. And it's being used by people in the state and adjacent to the state, who are the deep state, you could say, that are using this ignorance for their own purposes. And those purposes are partly, in fact, in large measure, the purposes, the Zionist purposes of the State of Israel and the Zionist movement. But it's also part of and allied to a deep state that wants to impose by military force its domination of other countries, and other countries which are currently dominated by the United States and which have puppet regimes of the United States installed there are sort of left alone. They're not, you don't see the U.S. Destroying those countries except by exploitation. But the other ones, which insist on being independent, and Iran is certainly a nation that wishes to remain independent, as does Syria and Iraq and Venezuela and North Korea and Nicaragua and Cuba and on and on. There are these that are considered problem states, problem countries that the United States has to deal with. And what the policy towards those countries has been and still is, that these countries have to be taught a lesson. And at the very least, they have to be destroyed. If they won't submit, then they have to be destroyed as an example to other countries as to what happens to them. So this, and this is very much part of the Zionist thinking, which benefits the state of Israel by using the U.S. military to fight the perceived enemies of Israel. So those interests are very much allied with each other, and that's not a case of ignorance. This is a case of very deliberate use of military force, economic force through sanctions, so-called sanctions, and destruction. And this is a theory of how the United States can continue to remain in power throughout the world.
Well, Elijah, continuing on that theme, I mean, do you think that it is because of a lack of understanding about Iran that there still is so much animosity and the actions that are taken against Tehran? Or is it actually because they have a very, very good understanding of Iran and the possibilities of Iran and its support, not only support for the resistance, but actually being the leader of the resistance?
I can't say that the U.S. Has a good understanding of what's happening in the Middle East, because we saw what the Americans did in Afghanistan after 20 years. We saw what they are doing in Iraq. They were asked to leave in 2011, and now they are asked and will be forced to leave. We saw what they've done in Syria. They're occupying a part of Syria, and they don't know what to do, to remain or to leave. And they really can't figure out what's the best solution. We see what they are doing in Lebanon. And yes, I agree with your guest about the element of Israel and Benjamin Netanyahu at the time when Donald Trump wanted the support of the Israelis in his re-election. And actually, Donald Trump blamed Israel for not going to war against Iran. Well, the Israelis are much more clever than the Americans at that time, because they know what the cost of a military confrontation with Iran, and what would be the consequences and the cost. Well, I think the Americans, everything they have done in the last decade was a total failure. From the beginning, when they say we're going to Afghanistan to destroy Al-Qaeda, they haven't been able to do that, to destroy Taliban. They negotiated with the Taliban, who are back in power. They say in Iraq they want the weapon of mass destruction. What they have managed to contribute in the rise of a resistance that is part of the axis of the resistance that was directed its strength and its attack against the U.S. forces. Now in Syria, it's picking up. In Lebanon, they were kicked out in the 80s. And now they're trying to come back with the sanctions. So I don't see any clever policy of the U.S. apart from an elephant in a China shop, just breaking left, right, and center, and then leaving without even saying, I'm sorry, and say, well, what I have destroyed is only the consequences and of what I have done, and you can live with it, because there is no accountability. This is why the Americans can do what they are doing, because they fear and consider they have no consideration to international law, and they have no consideration to any law whatsoever, because there is no accountability.
Well, Paul, your take on what Elijah said as far as the United States not having any accountability, I want to look at overall how this miscalculation, whether we're talking about with Iran or Afghanistan or Lebanon or Syria or so many examples that Elijah just brought, what has it done to the United States itself?
Well, I don't think you'll find many people in Washington that will admit to a miscalculation, and that includes the think tanks and the part of Washington that studies very carefully what's going on and so forth. But there's a lot of disagreement between the forces in Washington, and there's also a lot of arrogance. So you and I may call it a failed policy, but the.
Paul, I mean, if we just take Afghanistan, I mean, 20 years and how much money spent and leaving the way they did, I find very few Americans would say that was successful policy that they adhered to in Afghanistan with the results if we look at it.
Yes, that's what they would say, but that's not what they say in Washington. What they say in Washington is that this is time well used, because the influence of what's going on in Afghanistan, it gave them a presence in the Middle East, and it gave a warning to adjacent countries, don't mess with us, and all this kind of thing. This is the way they think. This is what I'm telling you. I'm not saying it's a good way of thinking. I'm saying that this is the so-called expertise that they have there, and they would say, yes, we didn't achieve everything that we wanted to achieve in Iraq, but on balance, it's still very useful. And as long as there's war going on and there's a war economy in the United States and the United States can destroy anybody on the face of the earth, we're in a good situation. That's the kind of thinking you're dealing with.
Okay. Well, Elijah, we just have about 1 minute. Your overall assessment, I mean, the United States, especially after the assassination of General Soleimani, many would say that the reputation, whatever was left of it, has deteriorated rapidly. Your analysis of the United States right now in the region compared to prior to the assassination, how it has deteriorated, and where do you see it going from here?
I think the assassination of Brigadier General Qasem Soleimani brought something new to the Middle East. Soleimani's death is more feared by the U.S. than when he was alive. And I think this has raised the awareness to so many people about what the Americans are doing in the area, in the Middle East, and what they are capable of, and how they think they can do whatever they want. And people are working to push the Americans outside the Middle East now as soon as is possible. And we see what's happening today in Iraq, where they are attacked every single day just for the Iraqi to make a point and say to the Americans, just leave us alone. We can sort out our problems without your presence.
And on that note, I appreciate both of you being with me here. Paul LaRudy, activist and political commentator out of Berkeley. Elijah McNear, veteran journalist and political analyst out of Brussels. Thank you both. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us right here.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Dear listeners, hello everyone. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Darsi, and in this edition, we will try to have a closer look at the 25th chapter, Surah Al-Furqan. First, let's just listen to the verses we're going to talk about in this program, and we'll be back shortly. So stay with us.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful. Blessed is he who, if he willed, could have made for you something better than that, gardens beneath which rivers flow, and could make for you palaces.
Brothers and sisters, in this 10th verse of chapter Furqan, the Almighty Allah talks about the bounties that he can give to the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam. He says, تَبَارَكَ الَّذِي إِن شَاءَ جَعْلَ لَكَ خَيْرًا مِنْ ذَلِكَ Blessed is he that if he wills, he could give you better things than that. Jannatin tajri min tahtiha al-anhar, gardens beneath which rivers flow. وَيَجْعَلْ لَكَ قُصُورًا, and he will give you palaces. But the Almighty Allah does not want to give different treasures to the Prophet. He does not want people to think that this is the personality of a prophet, depending on wealth, dependent on money and garden and palaces. The Almighty Allah wants the life of the prophet to be exactly like the lives of the common people, the usual people who go around, they do their businesses by themselves, and they go around in the markets doing their businesses. It is somehow the answer to the previous pretext of the pagans that said, why doesn't this kind of prophet have a treasure sent down upon him by the Almighty Allah? In fact, if the Almighty Allah had given him all these treasures, people would have believed in him without any problems. And in that case, the recompense, the rewardings, the glad tidings, even the chastisements would be meaningless. When there is no choice, when you are not free to choose the different sides, there will be no consequences. Because you were forced to choose one side, you did not do it intentionally, and thus, if you have chosen the right path, you do not deserve the rewards.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly, the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran. By Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
If the prophets had possessed such authority that could not be assaulted, or a kind of honor that could not be damaged, or a kind of domain towards which the necks of people would turn and the saddles of mounts could be set, it would have been very simple and easy for the people to believe in them, to seek lessons, and even invite the others to this kind of religion. They would have accepted belief out of fear felt by them. Or maybe they were inclined, and they were completely attracted. And the intention of the people all would have been the same, though their actions would have been different. So, the Almighty Allah decided that people should follow his prophets, should acknowledge his books. The people should remain humble before the prophets. They should obey his command. The people should accept the obedience of the prophet with sincerity, in which there should not be even an iota of anything else. Of course, in this case, the trial, the chastisement would be stiffer, but the reward and recompense, too, will be larger. Some say that the purpose of the word palace and garden is that of the other world. But this does not seem to be in line with the appearance of the verse completely. The Arabic word tabaraka, when it says in the beginning, tabaraka levi, and we translated it as blessed is he, is derived either from the meaning and sense of fix and everlasting, or from barakat, which means abundant goodness. But overall, it means that the existence of the Almighty Allah is completely fixed, and he is the one that originates the different blessings. And it is upon his willing, because it says, إِنْشَاءَ جَعَلَ لَكَ. If he wills, he will give you. So it is all depending on him, whether he wants to give us or he doesn't. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see. All the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Why? And that's when faith begins.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. Or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We will be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Snowfall and dropping temperatures have increased the problems of the poor and needy people across Afghanistan. Here, we are visiting some displaced families who face harsh conditions in their camps in Kabul. Bushra Amiria, mother of 10, is displaced from Helmand province. She says she has nothing to feed her children or heat her simple shack.
I am a widow and have several children. I'm really desperate to feed them and keep them warm. My neighbors used to help us, but now everyone is short of money and food.
Other people in this camp have the same problems. Almost all of them are deprived of their basic needs.
There is no hope for survival. We are left here with no house, no money, and no bread. We are human beings. Why is no one paying attention to us or help us? What should we do in this cold weather and severe snowfall?
These displaced families hope that the charities and the government could help them to survive the winter. Hundreds of men and women from two camps have come here to enlist them for receiving some aid. Bushra Amiri is happy as she receives some aid and food donated by the WFP and the Gulzad Group.
I'm very happy today because I have received some food for my family. My children will have something to eat for next month. We thank charities for their humanitarian aid. However, we need more assistance, including warming clothes and heating.
Afghanistan's financial system has been in a free fall since the Taliban took over, partly due to aid cuts and the freeze of some $10 billion in Afghan assets by the U.S.
In addition to dealing with cold weather, most of these families are unable to buy food and medicines. They say it will be very difficult for them to survive this harsh winter if urgent assistance is not provided. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Britain's highest rank for chivalry, awarded by Queen Elizabeth to former Prime Minister Tony Blair, a man described by campaigners as one of the most repugnant political figures in the world, in power from 1997 to 2007.
The backlash to the announcement has been immense and is only growing. Furious Iraq War veterans are now calling for the honor system to be overhauled. And more than 500,000 people have signed a petition calling on the Queen to strip the man they call a war criminal of his new title.
It's a designation routinely awarded to former prime ministers here, but anti-war campaigners say they're repulsed at seeing Blair receiving it. And they have their reasons.
For millions of people in this country, it's an absolute insult, as it is to the people of Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, and various other places where we've now seen the war on terror over the last 20 years. And I don't see any justification for it whatsoever. I think that Blair never conceded that he was wrong about any of these things. The Chilcot inquiry, which was very, very critical of him, he immediately held a very long press conference afterwards and said he would do exactly the same again.
In mid-February 2003, just before the Iraq invasion, tens of millions of demonstrators in hundreds of cities across the world, including in London, marched against the impending U.S.-led war in the Middle East. To Tony Blair, the biggest protest march in British history was fatuous.
The fact is that had we been listened to and had Britain not taken part in the war almost certainly would not have taken place, that America would have been much less likely to go to war alone. And we would have seen a much different world today, a day where far more people would be alive as a result of that war not happening, there would be far fewer refugees.
The U.S. claimed the regime of former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein possessed weapons of mass destruction and actively pressed for invading Iraq in late 2001. The weapons were never found. Two decades on, 1 million Iraqis dead, 3 million dispossessed, and a region reeling from terrorism and instability. Hundreds of British troops were also killed in the same conflict. Anti-war campaigners say Tony Blair belongs in the dock at The Hague and not in the pantheon of great leaders. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Cleared of criminal damage charges at Bristol Crown Court, Rhiann Graham, Myla Ponsford, Jake Scoos, and Sage Willoughby, dubbed the Colston Four, celebrated their acquittal in a trial that's divided British public opinion. For those who had been on trial, relief and a sense of vindication.
We are ecstatic and stunned. I tried to write something ready for this moment, and I'm just so overwhelmed.
We didn't change history, we rectified history.
We eliminated history. They lied. We eliminated history.
And this is a victory for Bristol. This is a victory for racial equality.
And this is where it began, at a Black Lives Matter demonstration in Bristol in June 2020.
I think the court accepted that this was almost a political show trial, that Boris Johnson and the Home Secretary, Priti Patel, had determined that they wanted to make an example of the Colston Four, and the courts rejected that.
The jury's verdict has garnered mixed reviews, with some MPs writing to the Attorney General asking him to look once more at the wrong result. Elsewhere, there have been calls for the Home Secretary to explain why this case was so heavily pursued in the first place, and what happens now when that move has seemingly backfired.
The focus is now on high-profile monuments like the statue of Sir Winston Churchill, Britain's lauded World War II leader, but a figure that's being seen increasingly through the lens of his controversial views on race and empire.
New legislation being pushed through under the Police and Crime Bill will make defacing monuments punishable by up to 10 years behind bars.
Women watchers to your station will be surprised to know you can get longer for pulling down a statue under the new provisions than you do for rape, which is absolutely bizarre. But it shows the extent to which this government is intent on pursuing culture wars and criminalising the Black Lives Matter movement.
There is the hope that many local and national stakeholders will use the outcome of the Colston 4 trial as a teachable moment, a chance to reflect on Britain's checkered past. But then again, maybe it will just be business as usual. Amina Taylor, London.
Hisham Abu Hawash has been refusing to eat for 141 days, but is finally breaking this fast because the Israeli regime has agreed to release him next month. Abu Hawash has been receiving a great deal of support from the Palestinian people, who have rallied, protesting his unjust detention and demanding his freedom. And now these people finally have a reason to celebrate. In Al-Khalil, Abu Hawash's home, his supporters have turned out to rejoice this victory against Israeli jailers. His family had an especially tough time in recent days after doctors warned that Abu Hawash's health was deteriorating, that he was slipping in and out of coma and facing the danger of sudden death. Now they can finally breathe a sigh of relief.
I thank all the Palestinians who stood with us. Thanks to everyone who helped my brother. I thank God they released him.
During the past 3 days, we lived through a psychological war that was carried out by the Israeli intelligence due to what was happening with my brother Hisham. There were strong maneuvers, but we overpassed those as a family. Today, Hisham achieved victory for all the Palestinians.
Now, Abu Hawash's lawyer says he would be hospitalized for medical follow-up before his designated release on February 26. Palestinian officials have weighed in, praising his resistance.
Hisham Abu Hawash prevails after 141 days of hunger strike. We hail Hisham for his forceful will, his family, Palestinian people, and people around the world who raise their voices in solidarity, thanks to countries that press Israel to release him next month on February 26.
Resistance movements have also poured praise on Abu Hawash, saying his victory should remind Palestinians how they can win every battle against Israel. The 40-year-old father of five children was arrested in October 2020 and started his hunger strike early 5 months ago to protest his detention without charge or trial that is allowed under Israel's administrative detention system. His lengthy hunger strike once again shed light on this illegal practice. Out of 7,000 Palestinians in Israeli jails, more than 500 are locked up without facing any charges or having a trial. For many of them, the last choice against this inhumane measure is to stop eating for lengthy periods of time. Still, the majority find themselves locked up in deplorable and non-standard conditions of the Israeli prisons, where they are sometimes even subjected to systematic torture and harassment.
In late 2020, Americans went to the ballots to pick the country's next president. 4 days after votes closed, Joe Biden was declared the winner. But the incumbent leader, Donald Trump, alleged vote fraud, and in doing so, shattered Washington's self-proclaimed image of the cradle of democracy. Trump adamantly refused to concede defeat after losing the 2020 presidential vote. On January 6, 2021, he called on his supporters to march on the Capitol and, quote, stop the steal. His fans attempted to do that. The world was shocked as news networks around the world showed thousands of Trump supporters forcing their way into the Capitol building, the symbol of U.S. democracy. Lawmakers engaged in the process of certifying the presidential election had to stop their task and flee for their lives. Some reports even suggest that a Republican senator was so frightened that he asked the Capitol security repeatedly to shoot the protesters. 5 people died in the chaos, one of them in the Congress building. To date, American authorities have arrested nearly 600 people and are looking for hundreds of more suspects. A big portion of the defendants stand accused of assaulting police officers. The FBI asked U.S. citizens to report each other out and tell the police if they knew anyone who had taken part in the riots. The incident inevitably had adverse consequences for the United States' image, both domestically and internationally. An opinion poll conducted last year by Harvard University showed that more than half of the country's young generation thought that American democracy is in trouble or failing. Moreover, an Axios survey indicated that now only 51% of the U.S. public thinks the next presidential election will be fair and free. Also, the Democracy Perception Index for 2021 showed that 44% of participants perceive the U.S. influence and meddling in the affairs of their countries as the biggest threat to democracy in their nations. At the same time, politicians and political analysts express shock and disgust at the chaotic scenes at the Congress grounds. Richard N. Haas, the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, said the attack signaled a post-American era. The assault on the Capitol changed the face of Washington, D.C. as well. The Congress building was fenced off on multiple occasions after the riots. Furthermore, Joe Biden's inauguration was carried out under heavy military presence, with an unprecedented 25,000 troops ensuring security. That was bigger than the number of U.S. forces present in Iraq and Afghanistan on the same day. The police reaction to the Capitol riots also raised questions about the U.S. law enforcement's differential treatment of white protesters. Whereas black people could be killed and injured for much smaller crimes, police were in fact criticized for their late and subdued response to the deadly protests by Trump's supporters.
Representatives of resistance groups gathered in Beirut to pay tribute to Iran's top commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, and senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. The two anti-terror icons were assassinated in an American drone strike outside Baghdad airport on January 3, 2020. Participants in the event all agreed that Soleimani united the region in the face of a common threat posed by the U.S. and Israel.
Their martyrdom did not weaken the resistance. On the contrary, it led to more accomplishments and success for the resistance. They are alive. This type of life is what gives a strength to the resistance. Martyr Qasem transcended his country to become the martyr of the entire nation, and this is an exceptional characteristic.
Hezbollah Deputy Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qasem stressed that people in the region will stand united and confront the threat posed by the United States. Meanwhile, the Secretary General of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad Movement, Ziad Nakhala, described Soleimani as the martyr of Palestine and Al-Quds.
The U.S. assassinated Soleimani because he was a barrier to American Israeli plots in the region. He transformed the resistance fighters into a strategic threat to Israel and the U.S. I take this opportunity to say that we're proud of the positions of the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is unwavering in its support for the Palestinian resistance, and I witness that Qasem Soleimani was at the forefront of the fight in defense of Palestine and the people of Palestine.
The Iranian ambassador to Beirut also said that there is a joint Iranian-Iraqi judicial lawsuit being followed up by both countries to try the killers of the Iranian and Iraqi martyrs who were assassinated by the United States.
Resistance groups in the region consider General Qasem Soleimani as a man and a leader who united them. People in Lebanon, even those who knew him only after his martyrdom, see him as a man who transcended borders and sacrificed his life for the sake of the people and regional peace and stability. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
This international conference is the gathering of Islamic scholars converged in the port city of Karachi against Islamophobia. They believe Islamophobia is a Western project to reshape Islam with tools like Daesh and others.
Participants of the conference stress on the need of unity among Muslims and call on the Islamic countries to take serious notice of the forces hell-bent to sow seed of discords among Muslim Ummah.
Documentary films during the past years over the gruesome acts of Daesh in the name of Islam were played to remind people how terrorist groups were weaponized by Israel and the U.S. to distort the face of Islam in the West.
Actually, Islamophobia is a project of Western country who do not like the Western people come to Islam like Islam. And they mention many things that hurt the heart of the Islamic people, while Islam is the religious of love between the people.
This conference is very important for me, all Pakistanis, and all Muslims, because there has been so many criminal activities on behalf of non-Muslims or Western countries against Islam and Muslims.
Member of the international conference warned the Islamic countries to act quickly against the possible future threats given the previous experience with the West.
Islamophobia had been created to balance the teachings of Ahle Bayt alayhimus salam. It was created to balance and misguide people from the way of Quran and Sunnah. Things took place in the name of Daesh and so-called. And they did things which were absolutely against the teachings of Islam. They never understood.
The delegation in the conference also stressed the significance of the eradication of Daesh from Iraq and Syria to save Islam and also save humanity from the plague of terrorist groups like Daesh, which is seen as a Western plot against Islam and the Islamic community. Mohammed Turi, Karachi.
Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah lashed out at the United States as the mother of corruption and terrorism in the region and stressed that the expulsion of U.S. forces from the region will be the final revenge for the U.S. assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi Popular Mobilization Unit's commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in Baghdad in 2020.
We have declared earlier that the best revenge is the full withdrawal of U.S. troops from the region. And over the past 2 years, as the leader Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei said, the U.S. has been forced to leave Afghanistan with humiliation. This has led the U.S. allies to rethink their alliance with Washington.
In an address to a ceremony in Beirut remembering the martyrs Qasem Soleimani, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, and their companions, Sayyid Nasrallah also accused the U.S. of being behind all Israeli and Saudi crimes in the region for decades.
The lesson which I would like to highlight today is that everyone acting for the sake of God emerges victorious in all battles and wins the hearts and minds of all people across the Arab and Muslim worlds. They show us that the U.S. serves as a real enemy and source of corruption, occupation, and terrorism in our region.
Allies believe that the project of the resistance continues to face the criminality of the U.S. in Lebanon and the region.
Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani belonged to the school of thought of a struggle against the occupiers of our land and those who destroyed our homes and killed our people and led one war after the other with their support for the Zionists. He sacrificed his life and stood against terrorism in Iraq, Yemen, Syria, and Lebanon and Palestine. He taught us that Lebanon is strong enough and can remove itself from the U.S. hegemony.
The leader of the resistance stressed that the assassination of martyr Soleimani, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, has triggered a new phase at the regional level. The assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and PMU Commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis is seen as an incident larger than the region itself, and for many analysts has brought to light a long-term confrontation for Lebanon's Hezbollah facing U.S. influence in Lebanon and the region. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host, Musa al-Bahadali, and you are now listening to the program Viewpoints. Joining us in the studio is our dear friends, Brother Ali Alawiyan and Brother Habib. I thank you both for joining us because we value your company a lot.
Thanks to you, brother. It's a great pleasure for us to be here.
Today, dear brothers, we will talk about lying. I am a Muslim, I'm a believer, or to make it more clear, I'm a Shia Muslim. And either I lived 500 years back under a certain Islamic country which persecuted Muslims, or I live in present-day areas where Wahhabism or anti-Shia sentiment is present. And it is directly threatening to my life if I, for example, pray on a turban, or if I say I'm a Shia Muslim. May I lie here, Brother Ali Alawiyan?
There is a greater experience here, which is called taqiyah, or dissemination.
This is a great expediency for the sake of the survival of the lives and souls of Muslims, and this is something that even we have a Quranic witness for that as well. Allah أن تتق منهم تقات. So we have even in Quran that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala refers to that and ask the companions of the Prophet, you can just deny your even Islam.